you're listening to Link Interview. I'm Jessica Iturralde. In today's program, we'll explore the link between religious freedom and national security,
and conclude with recommendations for a civil society program in connection with the 2024
Ministerial Conference in Berlin. Joining me today is Dr. Chris Seipel, Senior Fellow at Love Your Neighbor Community, also known as LINC. Before we get started, here's a little reminder that we depend on viewers like you to spread the word. So if you enjoy this program, please like and subscribe and share this program with someone you know. Dr. Seipel brings over 30 years of expertise in building social cohesion through inclusive strategies among diverse stakeholders. As the head of the Sagestone Group, he has worked with organizations like the Templeton Religion Trust and helped launch the Covenantal Pluralism Initiative, promoting collaboration and understanding across different sectors. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Seipel.
Well, thank you for having me, Jess. It's good to be here.
In our last episode of LINC Interview, LINC CEO Wade Cusack highlighted the importance of supporting international religious freedom, including how it helps to protect and strengthen societies. And in the episode, he gave several integral points, but one in particular was that religious freedom promotes dialogue, which diffuses tensions and encourages peaceful coexistence. In this episode, we're focusing on building and continuing peace and mitigating extremism. And with that, let's consider our first question. How does protecting religious freedom reduce violence and promote peace in multi-faith societies?
Well, thank you, Jessica, for the question. There's always two sides of a coin when you think about religious freedom in any society, which is going to be complicated, and certainly outsiders are not going to know it as well as those who live there. And the two sides are simply this: religious freedom is the right thing to do according to the beliefs of the different groups in society. There's always a golden rule: do unto others as you would do unto, as you would want them to do unto you. But the other side of the coin, and this answers your question, it's in your self-interest. It's in everybody's self-interest. Because if I protect the person who does not believe like I do, then those folks who do not believe like I do will protect me. It's a quid pro quo. And so there's a basic equation that works in most societies that it is in our interest for all of us to get along and to protect each other. The result of that is a stability that attracts foreign direct investment and creates context for the society to grow as a whole. So that's the basic equation of why this is in everybody's interest.
Just from the baseline, that sounds like a very reasonable, very logical approach. But in some policies, you know, they can be more restrictive. So how can restrictive policies on religious freedom exacerbate security risks, such as fostering extremism or radicalization, and particularly in volatile regions?
Most policies have the best of intentions. They want to preserve stability. And ostensibly, these policies and many of the places where they occur, there's some threat of extremism, a real threat, a legitimate threat, people who want to kill in the name of God or their understanding of God or their understanding of their own religious tradition. But the irony is that the more you repress a group, the more more likely they are to rebel against the state. This is only natural. Just think, if someone were to repress you and your family and prevented you from worshiping, and they accused you of threats that you didn't do. Well, over time, you are going to want to do something about that because you're getting tired of getting repressed. So what happens in general is that groups are repressed in a blanket manner. All of them are repressed. There's no nuance. Some of them are doing bad things, but not all of them. And the irony, again, is that the people who are not doing bad things, they're the ones you want to work with to speak to the people that are doing bad things, to understand that they are exercising not the full form of their faith, that they have a poor understanding of their faith. And if you think about it like this, who is going to understand best, or how best to relate to somebody Me as an outsider who is not of that faith, or an insider who is of that faith and has a better theological understanding. They're going to listen to somebody from their own faith. So don't repress everybody. Repress the people or go after the folks that are doing the bad things, and then work with the people who take their faith seriously to engage and try to prevent those who are trying to do extremist things.
It makes perfect sense that groups would be more susceptible to their own leaders or leaders in the religious community. So what role can religious leaders play in preventing extremism?
Well, religious leaders are in a difficult spot. On the one hand, in almost any society, they are more trusted than politicians because they speak for the faith. They allegedly know the faith and the Holy Scriptures the best. On the other hand, when they say things that sound like the government, they can lose their own credibility.
Can you expound on that?
So if the government saying, this is how you practice the religion, and then the religious leader says exactly the same thing, but there are legitimate grievances about people being repressed who are not doing anything bad, just practicing their faith, then the religious leader can be associated with the government. But that's only one side of the equation. What if the religious leader says something that sounds like what the extremists are saying? Then the government will come down on the religious leader. So let's take an example. In Islam, peace and justice are very important. Extremists will say the government is unjust. The government will say they are being just. What do you do with as a religious leader to balance that pressure from both sides? Because you want to teach people to live out their faith fully, but it's also true, perhaps, that the government is repressing some people who are living out their faith, wearing the hijab or whatever the case might be, bringing children to the mosque. So these things have to be negotiated very carefully within the cultural context. And the role of an outsider, I think, is to help create avenues of discussion between the government and the grassroots, between the top down and the bottom up. And at that nexus point, be a safe space that can facilitate an honest conversation between religious leaders and communities and their governments. Because the threat is real, and the extremists will manipulate real grievance against the government. Everybody has grievance against the government, any country in the world. Everybody's disappointed with what the government does at some point. But you don't want that grievance to be manipulated as extremism moves into terrorism, as bad thoughts and bad theology moves into bad action in the killing of innocent people. So the religious leader has to balance all these things. And often the religious leader has not been equipped to do so. They've been equipped to think about theology, but they've not been equipped to engage government and their communities as peace builders. And that's where Link, Love Your Neighbor community, comes in, and it can help facilitate that as the outsider in the countries where Link works.
Our interview continues right after this brief break. And with that, now is the perfect time to ask you, are you following us online? We are on Facebook, X, also remembered as Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Of course, you may find us on YouTube under Love Your Neighbor Community and on any major podcast provider, including Apple and Spotify. Could you give me an example of a time where an outside organization like Link came in and helped religious leaders be able to balance some of those challenges?
Well, Link is already doing this in Kazakhstan, for example, and in Uzbekistan too. And the basic premise is that they want to help equip religious leaders and government leaders to better engage each other according to the best, the local faith and culture. And so, for example, in Kazakhstan, Wade and the Kazakh government have done several events from the bottom up to bringing moms and pastors together. That's a beautiful thing, working with multi-faith neighbors networks in Kazakhstan, in the U.S., and again, with the Uzbeks. It's a regional effort. But on the other hand, from the top down, way in the Caspian University, which the government in Kazakhstan has authorized to teach government officials, he has created a cross-cultural religious literacy course about how to engage board government officials and presumably religious leaders who would attend Caspian University for a one-week certificate program. This program is going to be implemented in December for the first time in Almaty, Kazakhstan. So this is completely creative and innovative approaches that nobody has done before in a way that harnesses self-interest, back to self-interest. People want to get certificate programs. They want to get professional development about how to engage. But the process of getting the certificate is the process of bringing people into a room that would not otherwise meet. Government officials, religious leaders, and then they have relationships. And relationships allow for a better common understanding of the situation. To put it one last way in a simple sentence, relationships, conferences like these lead to talking. Talking leads to trusting. And trusting leads to tangible actions that can be taken together. You always have to go through that process, the talking, the talks, the trust, and the tangibility. You start with self-interest and the transactional, and you move toward the transformational because people begin to get to know each other as people, and they respect the essence of someone else's identity, not to demean it, but to dignify it and lift it up. And that doesn't mean you'll agree on theological things or political things, but it does mean you'll show respect for who they are. And when that happens, then there's the possibility of talk becoming trust and trust becoming tangible action from the top down and the bottom up in a manner that denies and deters extremism because religious leaders are working with government officials facilitated by a group like White.
Yeah, talk, trust, tangible action, the great practices to think about putting into place. So you talk about balance a lot, and I wonder whether or not the scales always balance out in circumstances, and if so, how do you measure whether a society is moving in a positive direction?
That's an excellent question, Jessica, and let me answer in a few levels. One is when you're in the building business, you're engaging complicated places that people in the West say they haven't made enough, quote, progress, and then leave progress undefined, except that you should basically look like us and have these international standards as we define them. And that doesn't always go down well, because people not in the West, which is the majority world, feel like they're making great efforts and they're doing it in their own way. Even in the context that there are lots of challenges there as there are here. So when I engage a place that is not up to somebody's understanding here in the West, I can get accused of faith washing, that I'm going there and I'm getting used by these people to say that everything is okay in this place where things aren't okay. Okay. But how else are you going to help change the environment if you don't understand them as they understand themselves and find ways to walk with them? Do you really think when you name, blame, and shame, you are enabling progress to take place? So that's a conversation here in America that happens a lot. And I am unapologetic about going to places where I think, one, God has called me to go, and secondly, to talk to people that I think are honest and seeking reform. I'm also aware of the self-interest. Jesus says, be shrewd as snakes and innocent as doves in Matthew 10:16. That's a mantra for me. So there's a balance about that and how you engage. But then to your question, how do you measure it? The U.S. International Religious Freedom Act created an annual report in 1998, along with the first ever U.S. Ambassador for International Religious Freedom, which happened to be my dad. So I've been following these things for 25 plus years. And there's a certain set of standards that are very broad and only for the country. And the reporting depends on how good the political officer is at the embassy and how high religious freedom is on their to-do list, when the embassies are usually understaffed and don't have all the staff and all the time to do things. So the reports can vary, is what I'm saying. And they're very broad and they're very general. There's a lot of excellent reporting with great specificity, depending on the country and the person, et cetera, doing it in the ambassador. Don't get me wrong. But it's a broad thing. And it's almost always quantitatively. Well, this many people out of prison, therefore they must be doing something. Well, what if we can have a balance, to your point, between quantitative and qualitative? Americans love to worship at the altar of quantification, but it's intellectually lazy. Because in most countries where you want to see progress on religious freedom, nobody's going to talk to you or do you what you want just because you want it. It's a time-intensive process of interviews and trust, as we talked about before. Talking leads to trust, leads to tangible action. And again, this is why Lake has had such an impact in places like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, because Lake goes there and always goes there and does not embarrass them in public, but speaks the truth behind closed doors about how to improve because of the trust. So we have to improve how we understand the balance of advocating versus building, that when you engage a place like this, it is not always fake washing, that you can do so with honor and integrity and respect and obedience to the commands of your own faith. But then we have to balance quantitative with qualitative and how attitudes have changed, not just people out of jail. People out of jail is awesome, but it's a tactical reaction. How do you change the structures of persecution so they don't go to jail in the first place? You change the structures of persecution by changing the minds of those who lead the structures. So you've got to engage government officials, and you got to educate them early on as they go through their career and work with them and walk with them for a generation or two before you see a true change in attitudes that affect the structures, that affect how policies, laws, and even the Constitution are revised as a result of those long-term relationships. I call it relational diplomacy for a reason, and not everybody's called to it. But we have to do that in a way that is measured, allowing for qualitative and quantitative balance of measurements, and also allowing for balance of advocacy. Traditional advocacy, name, blame, and shame, versus building, which means you go into the culture and you walk with the people who actually live there.
Yeah, I really appreciate that concept of relational diplomacy and what you said about balancing advocacy and building communication. That hopefully leads to changing the structures of persecution to begin with. Now, connecting back to national security, what are the best practices for integrating religious freedom protections into national security frameworks without compromising on counterterrorism efforts?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jessica. And we should remember that too much tolerance leads to terrorism. We don't like to think about that in the West sometimes, but it's true. You can tolerate things too much and allow groups to become extremists and then therefore move from extremism of thought to terrorism of action and killing innocents. So that is always real and always possible. So there always has to be a balance between the freedom to something, a liberty, and the freedom from something, a security. Security and liberty are two sides of a seesaw. And you have to operate at that fulcrum that balances the seesaw between liberty, freedom to something, and security, freedom from something. And the balance is going to shift according to the geopolitical, social, cultural, context in that country. It's always moving. So how do you make that a part of national security policy? Well, I think first you have to take it again from the top down and the bottom up. The top down, you have to begin with educating government officials about how to think about this. Oftentimes people have never thought about it. They see a threat and they use a hammer. And if the only tool you have is a hammer, then everything is going to get hit, which makes the situation worse, as we previously discussed. So how do you enlarge the toolkit for the policymaker? From the bottom up, how do you do the same thing for the religious leader to think about how they engage the government? They've never been taught how to do that either. And then you start getting into other topics, like the rule of law. What does the law actually say? And what are the policies? The law can say one thing, but the policies might be different. And then, if you go from policies to laws, you also have to think about the Constitution. Does the Constitution say things? Are these three things in alignment with the same language and the same understandings of those terms of reference and the same definitions? One problem, for example, in Eurasia is that many different countries have many different understandings of extremism. So we're never going to get at a common understanding of extremism, but we can ask and push for a understanding of extremism in a particular context so people on the ground can know where the boundaries are. In Germany, Hezbollah Tahrir, an extremist group, is banned for hate speech. Hezbollah Tahrir has created hate speech, and many extremists and terrorists have come from them in Central Asia. But in other countries in Europe, Hezbollah Tahrir is not banned. Why is it banned in Germany? Because they have a lot of experience with hate speech, going back 80 years to the Nazis. Is that the right approach? I don't know, but it's their approach. And the countries of Central Asia would agree with Germany. The Americans and the Europeans would say that's the wrong approach. More freedom of speech. The point is, where does the conversation take place that allows all these perspectives to form and inform discussions about constitution, law, and policies, and then how religion is taught? That's the beauty of LINC. It creates that space between top down and bottom up because it's trusted by government and grassroots. It's a very unique gift. And it needs to be stewarded well and supported well because there are too few organizations that are capable of doing it.
Our interview continues right after this brief break. Stay informed with LINC Radio, your go-to source for the latest updates on religious freedom around the world. We bring you breaking news, policy developments, and expert analysis on how governments, faith communities, and civil society are shaping the future of religious freedom. Don't miss out on the stories that matter. Tune in at linkcommunity.org, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify for timely insights and global perspectives. Stay updated, stay engaged, stay linked.
Sounds very complicated.
It is, but it's as complicated as a marriage or relationships with your kids. People say, and said to me many times in my life, I could never do what you do. Well, yeah, you do. You do do what I do, because it's as complicated as understanding and knowing your best friend, your spouse, and your children or family or your own community. Everybody has their own opinion. And what we all do as humans is we project ourselves onto others. In political science speech, this is called mirror imaging. And so I can have a conversation with my wife or a Central Asian official. I think I know what they're thinking, but in truth, I don't, because I'm not putting myself in their shoes. And I need to walk in their shoes as my neighbor to understand. And as a person of faith, my command is to love God and to love neighbor. But to put it differently, I'm not loving my neighbor unless I love them in a language and logic that they understand. Because the neighbor is the point of reference, not me. And that is the essence of doing this well, creating a safe space where people can talk top down and bottom up. They may not feel like they're being, quote, loved, but we're loving them in a language and logic so they can communicate with each other because they trust us enough. They may not trust each other, but they trust us enough, the outsider. And we're setting an example of how to love in a language and logic that is understood by them. It's never perfect, just like a marriage or a family. But the point is you keep getting better. It's trying to be better each day because you love your family. And because for those of the Abrahamic faith, and particularly for Christians like me, we love God, we love Jesus. We have to get better each day. Otherwise, we're not living the life that we're supposed to.
Yeah, I like your earlier analogy of a toolkit, because even thinking in something like marriage or communication, I think of having a toolbox of some sort, different tools, and especially things like active listening and putting yourself in someone else's shoes and additional things.
Yeah, one more thing about marriage and international relations. The best definition of marriage that I've ever heard is the day you wake up and you realize the person next to you is not you. And the same is true of international relations. Again, it's the projecting and the mirror imaging. So we expect everybody to think like us. Well, that's the wrong way to think about it. You got to talk to people there. It doesn't mean your opinion is any less when you talk to people there and try to understand them better, but you try to introduce your ideas in the context of how they understand themselves. And so that is foremost what's going on in Germany.
I think that's very interesting to think about when we think about communication of any kind. And I know coming up next month in October, we have our ministerial conference in Berlin, where we'll talk about the freedom of religious belief and national security specifically. So what would be your recommendations for that conference, especially for the regions facing religious persecution?
To answer your question, some background, you can see this picture behind me. It's not clear on the screen, I'm sure, but it's a picture of me at the Berlin Wall. And that rock in front of it comes from the Berlin Wall. I was there in November of 1989 when it came down. And it's interesting because Germany has this history of fascism from the right, but also this history of communism because they were essentially occupied by communist Russia. And at that time, both of these, the fascism and the communism, were overthrown. And a freedom came into Eastern Germany and the unification of Germany. The irony of the Berlin ministerial next month is that three states within Germany recently held elections, and the number two vote getter in all three of those elections was a group called AfD, Alternative for Deutschland, Alternative for Germany, and they're Nazi sympathizers. Another group, which is a communist sympathizer, BSW, also polled very well. So here's my point. We like to think about religious persecution as some problem that's over in Asia or the Middle East. It's not in Europe. It's not in America. But here's the simple truth. We're all human. And if allowed the opportunity, these ugly evils of fascism and communism will come back. And they do so by stereotyping the other, beginning with the Jews, always the Jews first, and then the minorities. In the case of Germany, Muslims who came there fleeing ISIS. But fix your country, there's an immigrant problem, where people want to blame those coming in because they're not there, goes back to legitimate grievances. And so this threat is real and ongoing, which is why religious freedom and security have to be better understood. That when we allow people to practice their faith and define their story in an inclusive citizenship story of the country where they are, there will be stability. But if immigrants and people or minorities in any country do not find their story in a larger story of inclusive citizenship, then we come back to your first question. They're going to feel oppressed. They're going to feel repressed. And over time, they're going to want to do something about it. So in Berlin, one of our goals for the civil society programs is to bring in majority world voices to the conversations about religious freedom from Central Asia, from Africa, from Latin America. And listen, too often these religious freedom, global religious freedom meetings are just Europeans and Americans looking at the rest of the world, which is the majority world where the majority of people live, and saying, why don't you look like us? And we don't even acknowledge our own problems. Hey, I think America's pretty great, but we got to be humble in how we engage. And we have to be humble in how we listen. So let's give an equal platform to the majority world and say, how are you guys thinking about this? How do you think about extremism? And then they listen to each other because you're going to hear different perspectives in their own voice, not somebody from the West telling them what to think or do. And what have we done there? We honor God, whose greatest gift is the freedom of conscience, and people decide for themselves about how to think about what's best for their country as they listen to comparative examples. And so because this has really never been done before in this format, in a religious freedom platform, my hope is that we set a pattern and then we listen very carefully afterwards. And we see, okay, what did you think about this, folks from the majority world? How did you think about it? What lessons did you take away? So that's the overwhelming goal of this meeting, is to create a context of listening in the language and logic of the neighbor while not shying away from the universal values of religious freedom that are found in every culture, and balancing those things and creating a community of practice that can move forward, supported by a culture of philanthropy locally and regionally that will support these kinds of ideas. Donors don't want to support white Christians from America who say religious freedom is for me, but not for thee, to state one of the stereotypes that exists in the world about religious freedom. It's only Christians from America worried about Christians overseas. Christians in America care very much about all people overseas because they believe God, that all people overseas are made in their image, is made in the image of God. But there is the perspective among majority world countries that we only care about Christians. So how do you overcome that stereotype? You have conversations about things that are of interest to them. Extremism is certainly of interest to many countries in the majority world because they have legitimate threats.
Profound words, Dr. Seipel. Thank you for that. For those watching who may be interested in learning more, Link and our partners, the IRF Secretariat and Templeton Religion Trust, will be conducting a series of events in Berlin from October 8th to October 10th. The event is a civil society program in connection with the 2024 ministerial that will be held in Berlin, Germany. You can find more information on that event on our website at linkcommunity.org. And with that being said, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Dr. Seipel, for sharing your expertise and your recommendations.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for the great work.
I'm Jessica Eachwalde, and you've been listening to Link Interview. For more information on religious freedom building, including reports, stories, and case studies, visit linkcommunity.org. Additionally, if you found today's program valuable, please like, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and share this program on your social media. Thanks for tuning in.